Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This holiday season's blockbuster read may not be a book at all. On Monday, Amazon debuted the much-anticipated Kindle, its electronic book reader. It's a handheld device that gives you access to 88,000 book titles. Critics warn the very future of reading and our literary culture is at stake. This hour, On Point, Reading 2.0 and Whether the Printed Word is Passé. With me in the studio is essayist and literary critic Sven Burkertz. He's the editor of the top-tier literary journal Ogni at Boston University and teaches at Harvard and Bennington College. He's written several books, including the 1994 bestseller The Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in an Electronic Age. Welcome.
Hi.
And joining me from New York is Stephen Levy, senior editor and technology columnist at Newsweek. He wrote this week's cover story, The Future of Reading. He's author of numerous books on technology, most recently, The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Sheila.
And I'm going to start with you because you have held this, I presume, in your hand, this new Kindle, this new e-book reader, and I haven't. I've just seen pictures of it and video of it. So tell us about it.
Okay, yeah, I've had one for about 3 weeks, and one thing it does do, and the key thing is Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, and sort of the impresario of this device, says is that the book has to disappear. That when you read a book, whether it's a physical book or an electronic book, what really matters to you is connecting with the author and going off to some other world, really, when you read and not really noticing that you're holding an object, but basically just getting to some flow state where you've channeled that author's world there. And the Kindle does that. And it uses this technology called e-ink, which looks like ink on a page. As a matter of fact, quite literally, it takes advantage of a chemical, which is like a lot like ink, underneath the surface of the screen that rearranges itself. It's not backlit. You need light on it just like a regular book. So it does that. And the Kindle does one other thing, major thing. This is really, really important that no other ebook did before, and that it's connected. You could go to the Amazon Kindle store. It's a subset of the big Amazon store with about 90,000 books in it, and get any book you want from those 90,000 and pretty much anywhere, because it uses a form of wireless connectivity which is available everywhere, and download it in about a minute or less. So that's a big advantage.
But one thing, by the way, on the Amazon website, I was a little confused about the cost of this Wi-Fi connection, because they don't exactly say it's free. They say, we'll take care of it for you. So is
right.
that gonna, would that be a cost?
It's not a Wi-Fi connection.
It's not.
Because there's a lot of good reasons why it's not. At Wi-Fi, you have to worry about finding a hotspot. Sometimes you get charged for it. And a lot of places, you're driving in a car. You're just not near a hotspot. This is based on a cellular connection, broadband connection. It's called EVDO, one of those crazy acronyms. But normally, for an EVDO connection, you pay $60 a month. For the Amazon is swallowing that charge. You don't have to subscribe to it. It's included in the rather steep price of the device itself.
And that price is going to be
$400.
$400. Maybe I missed it. Did you tell us about the size and shape of this thing?
Right. It's about it's somewhere between the size of a mass market paperback, bigger, a little bigger than that, and a little smaller than a trade paperback, just in terms of what it presents to you. The screen itself is a 6-inch screen. It's thinner than a pencil. You could hold it very easily and get comfortable with it. It has real big buttons to turn the page and go back a page to accommodate different positions you get in when you read over a long period of time.
And it you talked about the e-ink, but unlike a computer screen, this is not backlit, right?
You need
light in the room or wherever you are to be able to
read
it.
Right, you need light in the room or book light. You can read it in sunlight. So if you're fumbling for your keys, you're not going to use a Kindle and turn it on like you do sometimes on a cell phone screen to find out where the lock is.
You said, Steve, that you've had one for 3 weeks. How does it feel in your hand? What's it like?
It feels pretty good. I've read about three full books on it. I read the newspaper on it. You can also get newspapers on the thing. So I get the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. To be honest, if my New York Times, which comes every day in physical form, gets up the door first, and is available when I wake up, I'll go for the physical paper. But on the subway, it's easier to read the Kindle. I'm happy to, if the paper isn't there yet, to read the stories on the Kindle.
You don't find it awkward?
The interface could be improved for newspapers. I think eventually, maybe with a touch screen, there's this thing called the New York Times Reader, which you can get on the computer, which is a really great interface for newspapers. But once you're reading a story, that's fine there. It really is optimized for reading books.
Well, let me turn to literary critic Sven Burkertz. This all sounds kind of intriguing. How does it strike you?
Well, I'm listening to Stephen, and I'm thinking that I'll probably have to play his foil today. And for starters, probably move the conversation off of the technical, which is just not my realm, and slightly more into
I do not plan to ask you a single technical question, Steve.
I find it, in my deep, deep Luddite soul, I'm anxious and worried. I'm also, in my other soul, whichever one that is, I'm fascinated and provoked to think about this and the ways that it is now sort of clarifying and reframing so many things that are absolutely central in our culture, like the Reading Act and like the dissemination of information and all that.
Okay, can you, losing me here.
Okay, well, my take
let's,
on this.
Let's focus on the Reading Act. What do you think this is going to mean for the Reading
Act? Well, for one thing, I've noticed
the act of reading.
Even in the little bit that I've read since Kindles has been announced and brought forward, and all of the discussions in recent years, it seems, that have to do with ways to sort of remake the book and to make the book digitally friendly and so on, there's a kind of underlying presumption which seems to be that reading itself remains the same and that it's just we're just changing some of the frames of it and some of the devices and the how-to part of it. And I guess for starters, my deep bias is that reading itself is tremendously changed by the presence and the reflexes that we have around screens. And this is a screen event. It's not a page event. And I think that we necessarily will bring to this our screen impulses, which are different, and they have to do with Matters 2.0. They have to do with interactivity. They have to do with simultaneity and peripheral awareness going on at all times. And I see that as fundamentally opposed to reading in the purest sense in which I would talk about it, which for me is literary reading, focus.
Well, it's not, Sven, as if reading is doing all that well in our culture.
Well,
the
not.
National Endowment for the Arts reports this week that fewer, especially young people, are reading at all for pleasure, are reading less and less. Reading seems to be on the decline in the mass culture. Is there any chance this
right,
could be a shot forward?
Right, but if we pull the camera back a few yards and I'm not the first to say this, but one of the leading suspect causes of this decline is also the screen itself and the amount of time spent by, especially, you know, the younger people who are the most vulnerable to this and who are the ones showing, you know, the declines, the precipitous drops in readership. I mean, one of the main reasons Advanced is that there's a lot of competing media action, and that also I think this competing media action makes the book seem increasingly less easy to engage, less appealing, and more something to be moved past. So if this new technology, this new reader comes in and helps in any way to redress that, well, sure, that's in the plus column. It would be in the plus column, too, if it saved trees. So I'm not completely polarized about
okay,
this.
I'm not trying to push you into a corner. But
oh,
let me
you can, but
let me turn to Stephen Levy on a few of those points. But your article in Newsweek is headlined, The Future of Reading. What about the impact that this could have? You've used this thing. Is it a screen event more than a page event?
No, I actually would say when you're in a book, it's a reading event. One thing that the Kindle doesn't do is there's not, you know, pop-up windows. You don't get your email on it. There's no email on this. The only time that email comes into the equation at all is if you want to send a document, a Word document, say, to the Kindle. You mail it to your address or a friend can, and it shows up like a book. You could read. So in the article, I do use the Kindle as a jumping off point to talk about some of these same issues that Sven's talking about. But to me, the issue is not so much one of distraction, but one of to what degree reading and writing is going to be more of a participatory event. Some of the future of reading, as you know, it's been discussed by people who are looking into this. It reminds me of this phrase that science fiction writer William Gibson used, saying the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. Some of that future, I think, you could already see on the web, where you have authors sort of writing their books in public. Like they have a blog, they get feedback.
Stephen Levy, stick with us, and Sven, sure. Sven Burkitz of Harvard. We're going to talk a lot more about this. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the new reality of reading, how technology is affecting book culture, American readers, and culture at large. My guests this hour are essayist and literary critic Sven Burkitz and Stephen Levy, technology columnist at Newsweek. He wrote this week's cover story, The Future of Reading. And Stephen, you were in the middle of a point when I cut you off about people writing books sort of publicly online.
Right, right. And then the other thing is that, and one thing that the connected devices like the Kindle will eventually be able to do is keep people in touch with other readers. As one person said to me, you could have a book club inside a book. So that is a potentially disruptive thing to the reading experience. On the other hand, it could be interesting to pause in reading and see what either your peers or experts, critics have to say about what you're reading. And then as books themselves become increasingly digitized and put into libraries that you could search for them, you could find links to other books. So you could say, if you're reading particularly a nonfiction book and you want to learn more about a subject that just came up in the book, you could instantly go to any other book and maybe read a paragraph about that.
But that, I must say, sounds to me a bit like we're getting towards surfing. I don't know whether that's what Sven is worried about or not.
Well, I was going to say that as far as when I listen to this, I feel dread in the deepest heart of my literary soul. And I think the issue finally, way behind this question of the book itself, really is an issue about the nature of interactivity and about the nature of collaborative and interactive processing in everything, whether it's knowledge or expressive art. And to me, that's the terror point, because I see the book, in fact, as a kind of citadel of the idea of the individual and of subjectivity. And when I see the burgeoning possibilities for increasingly networked collaborative ventures, something in me just turns to stone. I have to say it. That to me is not the golden future, but it's a kind of, hive life future.
Let's see what some of our listeners have to say. Brad is calling us from Kansas City, Kansas. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Sheila.
I understand you just ordered one of these?
Just ordered it about 2 hours ago. I read about it on the New York Times, and I'll tell you what really sold me is you can get the New York Times on the Kindle as well, and I was very excited about that. So I figured, what the heck, I'd give it a try. I'm a voracious reader, and I thought I'd give it a try.
So there are other e-readers out there. What is it about this one that got you off the couch and onto the computer to order this one?
I like the fact that you can download books or newspapers. You don't have to be hooked into your computer. You can, it just does it automatically. I did some research. In fact, I read your guest article on Newsweek about the Kindle this morning before I ordered it, and basically knowing every morning when I get up that I have the newest edition of the New York Times is something for me. This Kindle will pay for itself for me in a year and a half because it's costing me $50 a month for the New York Times. I can get it online for $12.
So it sounds like you're focusing a lot on using this for periodicals, for newspapers. Is that as big a goal for you as books?
Books are a big goal as well. But right now I kind of went through and I saw some books, and I like the fact that Amazon is charging, about half price of the book, so I'll be definitely downloading some books. But the deciding factor for me was obviously the ability to download the New York Times and newspapers and periodicals. But yes, I will be reading books on it.
Okay, thanks, Brad. Stephen Levy, that's obviously music to Amazon's ears that somebody is reading your story and churning to order this. Is this what they're expecting?
Well, it's what they're hoping for. I want to return to a point that Sven made. He used one word which I thought was sort of interesting. He's talking about, the books as a citadel. And John Updike, when he was talking about some of the things, bandied about that might be in the future of reading, talked about, the book as a fortress. To me, look, I'm an author. I've written six books, and in those books, the total attention of the readers that I had. And I love the idea that I dominate this conversation between us while they're reading the book. I don't think that's going to go away. I think that, there's a potential for that conversation maybe to be augmented by connectivity. There's also a danger, and I have some of the same fears that Sven has, that could be intruded upon. On the other hand, it's useless to talk about things in terms of citadels and ramparts and protecting the sanctity of something. It's really only going to be the quality of these authors and the experience to keep that channel going, which is going to have long-form literature and nonfiction persist into this era, which, like it or not, is going to come. There is no way, as someone said to me, and I totally buy this, in 50 years we're going to be chopping down forests and shipping papers around and putting ink on them and throwing them in bookstores. The Kindle delivers and things like it deliver a certain level of quality to the reading experience. You could argue it's not quite up to where the physical book is, but I think it's over enough hurdles that we could certainly see within 20, 30, 40, 50 years, the experience will be fantastic. It's only been 50 years since computers themselves filled up entire rooms and cost millions of dollars. To think that we're not going to take the steps to make something like the Kindle to be like a fantastic reading device in 50 years is just ridiculous. So, we really could be getting past the idea of protecting citadels and figuring out the best way to preserve the best of what we have now. And some of that is that great extended lecture, really, that the author gives to the reader in engagement and take that into the next era.
I think I'm going to beat myself up all day for having used the word citadel. It's not the best choice.
You opened it out the door there. I'm sorry.
I think that... in a way, it emphasizes to me, I suppose I chose it more for its emphasis on materiality. I was struck right at the outset by the comment or the announcement by Jeff Bezos that the book has to disappear. And I think that's exactly, in a sense, what will happen. But what we're forgetting as everything becomes streaming fluid text is all the ways in which books form a societal context, and that they are a book is a historical, tangible entity. And as part of the great onrush into this fluidity, and I completely agree, in 50 years the war will be over, but somebody has to be lamenting, and that's what I'm
and
doing
you're so good
here.
At it.
I think always in terms of tendencies, and the tendency that starts here and then sort of exponentially grows into increasingly sort of networked data flow. My area of worry is what that does to our own purchase on our sense of self and how we live in the world. And I worry about a kind of sort of fluid dream of signals and texts flowing and everyone happily canoeing along. There's something in me that just is constructed to resist that.
Well, you should not feel lonely. I think Maureen, who's calling us from Worcester, Massachusetts, agrees with you. Maureen? Hi, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This has been such an interesting conversation. Thank you. I have 6 children. My husband and I are avid readers, and I'm pulled over on the side of the road, and the police officer's pulling up behind me here. what I want to say is that my kids love to read. They're very digitally savvy, and I just have to tell this guy that I'm okay. Hold on one sec here. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay.
We're going to put Maureen on hold,
This is reality radio.
This is live. This is definitely live radio. I'm still not sure I understand, Sven, what it is that is causing such angst in what you referred to as your Luddite soul.
Well, I think for me, as I'm trying to say, the bottom line has to do with a certain definitions and boundary lines having to do with a notion of self and of subjectivity.
Well, is it the idea that perhaps authors will be able to, that the book won't kind of sit in its first edition and its second edition, but the editions may all merge together if it's constantly electronic? Is that the impermanence that worries you?
Well, I'm fascinated, for instance, by the idea of a universal database, which Kevin Kelly wrote about a year ago in the New York Times Magazine, this notion that everything after it is scanned will also be linked and cross-linked, and that a kind of future image of a possibility is that all data will basically be accessible to everyone in a kind of almost overwhelming sort of universe of data, and that we will pilot our way through this with our highly refined technologies. The image of that is not to me appealing, though I can see that to others it might be. I just have to stand up for a kind of unreconstructed older idea of how we live.
Ken is calling us from Brookline, Massachusetts, and seems to identify himself as a big fan of yours.
Ken, bring him on.
Yeah, we're bringing him on. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Sven. How are you? A great admirer. I read the Gutenberg Elegies when it came out and thought it was fabulous. And I completely sympathize with the issues you have concerning interactivity and reading. But I also have to say I'm one of the guys who watched Jeff Bezos demonstrate the Kindle last night on Charlie Rose and immediately went out and ordered one this morning. And I did it for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm one of those people who has a really bad habit of reading about 20 different books at the same time.
Why is that a bad habit?
Well, because it means that you're always walking around trying to say, what'll I leave at home and what'll I take with me? I have Jeffrey Toobin's book about the Supreme Court. I have The Omnivore's Dilemma. I have 3 mysteries. And I'm looking at a new series of historical novels by a guy who sort of who's maybe the heir to Patrick O'Brien. But my point is that the idea of being able to have 200 books in something that, as far as I can see, seems not much larger than an ordinary paperback seems fabulous to me. So that's one of 2 issues that it seems to me that nobody here has talked about, and that is access to a lot of different things that you read all the time, and not even necessarily periodicals, just regular, long nonfiction and fiction books. The other thing is, I wonder what the implication is ultimately going to be down the road for small independent bookstores. The problem is, I think this evolution is kind of coming, but I don't see a way, or right now, there's not a clear line for me. I buy cookbooks. I buy books that I want to physically hold and look at again and again from small independent bookstores. But I'm more than willing to buy a device like this, for example, and put all of the disposable books that I read all the time on it. I have bookcases up the wazoo in our house. I read 75 books a year, and there's no more space. So.
And now they'll fit in a much smaller space. Let me ask Stephen Levy to weigh in on that question of the impact on bookstores and, I presume, by analogy, on publishing.
Well, I think that if you look far down the road, in this time when pretty much everyone really can't avoid, like it or not, the idea that eventually books are going to be digitally distributed, I don't see these superstores, these Barnes & Noble superstores, proliferating anymore. They'll be the Tower Records of tomorrow. On the other hand, maybe the smaller places, the niche places, that do still sell physical books, my guess is they'll have an audience, maybe even thrive. I imagine a literary book comes out 30, 40 years from now. There will be a small printing for people who want to hold it and put it on a bookshelf. It'll probably cost more than you buy now, and the electronic version will probably cost less in hopes that lots of more people buy it.
Sven.
I was at a conference 3 days ago at Mount Holyoke College called Book to Blog, and Jason Epstein presented there, and he has a thing which is basically a high-end books on demand technology, which is pretty much ready to go and may already be up. He made a very convincing case for pinpointed paper creation and distribution from electronic files, which I wondered also just these things seem, I heard about that on Friday and then this on yesterday, and it does really seem like, I wonder if these are two racers going neck and neck to a ribbon, or if there's room in the field for all of this. I think in the beginning it will be both and, no matter how we cut it, but the question is, again, looking down two or three decades down the road, what the landscape is going to look like.
Well, I mean, certainly coffee table books aren't going to fit into the Kindle, Stephen Levy.
No,
or are they?
No.
But what about,
I think in something like that, it'll be quite a long time before you can get that sort of experience, some sort of electronic device. And I think a coffee table book that, you page through and pour over and share with other people, it will be less likely to be poached off by something like this.
But what about the book with the...
At this point, you would never buy a big art book on the Kindle as an electronic book.
But what about the book with the lovely topography, or just, not a book that's mostly pictures but has some strategic pictures? How does the Kindle handle that?
You can see the illustrations on the Kindle, but basically the books as art, I think, will be less impervious to be poached by electronic books. There are certain printmakers who just make beautiful, beautiful books as art, and I think, as maybe physical books themselves become more rare, pursuit for collecting books as objects, my guess might even be bigger. I actually showed the Kindle to one of the best, the most successful rare book dealers in the country, who's a friend of mine, about a week ago. I gave him, I sneaked him a look there, and I thought that he might be horrified, but he actually thought, oh, this is interesting. I know this is inevitable. This looks pretty good. This isn't going to affect my business at all.
We're talking about the future of reading and the impact of technology on what and How We Read. And we are talking this hour with essayist and literary critic Sven Burkertz. He's the author of The Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in an Electronic Age. And with Stephen Levy, senior editor at Newsweek, he wrote this week's cover story, The Future of Reading. And he's the author of The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. I'd like to go immediately to talk to Matt, who is calling from Boston. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Sheila. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I sort of have a comment, and I'd like to know what your guests think about this. I think one thing that hasn't really been touched on, except maybe very lightly, is sort of the isolation that comes along with this technology. I've seen it already with iPods and MP3 players where people have their headphones on and they're sort of in their own world. And also, you think about things like a book or a record that used to be an object that you could be passed from one person to another. And the sharing of a book, the sharing of a paperback book that you love, that you have on your shelf, and giving it to someone to read or letting someone borrow, it seems like that gets lost with these kinds of devices. And it really takes away this whole kind of human interaction aspect to reading, which I don't think anyone has really talked about. We've been talking about the experience of reading, but there's a whole kind of culture that goes with it that I think hasn't really been discussed, and I think it's going to get lost with devices like this.
Thanks, Matt. I'm going to ask Sven to address that, because I sort of thought Sven had the opposite take, that this isn't the Kindle isn't isolating enough.
Well,
so maybe I'm missing something.
I found that aspect of the question really interesting, because reading has always been extremely isolating as an event, but it's a peculiarly isolating because it's sort of isolating through immersion in another world, whether it's a created world or a world of information or narrative. I think the difference between, I think it's another device that allows for public isolation, which I think is what the iPod also does. It's not that when people listen to music, they aren't often alone, but the phenomenon now, whether it's with cell phones or iPods, and now possibly this, is that people moving in a formerly public space, but designing and declaring that space as their own use zone or whatever we want to call it, which has a sort of collectively alienated effect, I think.
Well, as someone who I've written a book about the iPod and deal with the isolationist critique of that there, but in this case, it seems to me that the situation is identical of that of reading a book. I read my Kindle today in the subway. In the same way, I would read a book, and I was reading a book. And I actually think it's interesting here that that some of the arguments against people using video games and how they're just wrapped up in that and off in a world of their own will be launched against reading books now because books happen to be delivered electronically. That seems bizarre. On the other hand, your caller has an excellent point in some of the limitations, at least that we're currently seeing in e-books now, and you can't lend it to a friend. You can sell it after you use it, and that's these digital rights management restrictions that are on it. On the other hand, we see on the web now that, and maybe this will reach the ebook readers, that in terms of a social community, this expands the possibilities. You could discuss a book. You're not limited to your friends who may or may not be interested in the particular book you're reading or may not have expertise in it. You could find a community built around the book. It's easier to build communities around books using connectivity and the web there. So I would say that there's also a possibility that the culture around a book could be widened and enriched by connectivity, whether it's in an e-book reader or on the web.
Stephen, how much of the appeal of this and the rollout of this is going to be just purely generational, that young folks take to it and older folks hang back? Not that I would ever call Sven an old fogey, but...
Yeah, I think a little less so than some devices like the iPod or certainly games. I think a lot of people you know, look, most people use computers, and you know, the Luddite strain is certainly loosening. I think in my conversations with people, a lot of people, particularly people who travel, a lot of people who buy a lot of books on Amazon, you know, you had a caller earlier that was just, you know, talking about he reads several books at once and he likes to take them along. I think those people, you know, in general are going to be interested in pursuing this.
But you have to remember, too, that as far as the younger demographic goes, you're pitching to a generation that's now been identified as finding email itself far too slow and that conducts most of its e-business, you know, via texting and instant messaging. So the idea that this is going to bring the neural bundles of these people back around to the books, I think it may bring reading in differently, and we have to look at that. That's a whole other conversation. I don't think it's going to replenish, you know, people finding their way to whatever, Anna Karenina, necessarily.
Well, Katie in Hudson, Massachusetts, has an idea of one way this might affect kids. Katie?
Yes. Hi, Sheila. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I was thinking about students and schools, and I can only think about the fact that, like, kids that have backpacks full of books, and they're very heavy, and sometimes they're out of date, and school systems that can't afford to, you know, replace their textbooks every year to keep things current and up to date. I can envision teachers, you know, handing out. Now, I think it would have to be a simplified, you know, that they couldn't do anything else on it but read the books, and made sturdily so the kids, you know, don't trash them. But the teachers hand them out at the beginning of school, and it has all their course books on them, and they can use them and then, you know, pass them on to the next class that comes in. And, you know, I remember in college, I mean, going to the book depository was like the major expense of my college education. And, you know, and then you had to sell back your used books, and half the time they were out of date or whatever. And I can just only see that can facilitate it in small school systems that, you know, again, can't afford to keep everything current, and, you know, they're using the out-of-date text and everything.
Interesting idea, Katie. Let me ask Stephen Levy. I was wondering, I mean, you're talking, Katie, about a school-wide use of it. But Stephen, I was wondering where textbooks are going to be on the rollout of adding more books to the library of what, 90,000 titles.
Well, part of the problem here is going to be how quickly the publishers want to embrace that. Right now, I think they have a pretty good deal. The one downside to their business model, you know, which requires you know, updating these books and having students pay a huge amount of money for them, is that they're bugged by the used book market. And maybe if they would lower their prices for the electronic models, electronic versions of books, they could, you know, not have to worry about, you know, these used copies coming along. The other idea is, you know, about the schools is kind of interesting, because maybe your listeners have heard of the EXO laptop put up by the One Laptop Per Child Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, that's designed to be sort of an e-book. You could swivel the screen and put it in the form factor of a reader. And that was a very conscious move on behalf of the designers of that computer, that very low-cost computer. It's supposed to be $100. It costs maybe twice that now, but that's still pretty good, half the price of a Kindle. And they're hoping that that will be, you know, used for textbooks and other documents, and, you know, that are going to help education of these kids in developing nations.
Before I forget to ask Stephen Levy, why is Amazon calling this Kindle?
Well, I think that they I'd like the idea of starting something, you know, igniting, you know, like the ignition of knowledge is the way I put it there. Some people have pointed out that it's almost like a Fahrenheit, you know, 450, whatever it is, you know, the thing, like, you know, people associate that with book burning, which is certainly not the impression they want to give.
Ooh, I had not thought of that. Let's talk to Lee. Lee is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hello.
Thank you. My question is, relates to some points that have already been made by your guest, but also influenced by a number of things, a couple of which have to do with surveys and things we see constantly about the fund of knowledge and the level of understanding. understanding and literacy across the country, young and old, and reports from academics, some of which I've talked to in person, who report that their students are incurious, don't want to learn, and certainly not interested in reading very much. Your subtitle of your program has the word change in it. Do any of you have any information or any reason to believe that a device, technology like this, is actually going to do anything to reverse this cultural attitude or tendency toward, you know, this? I'm very negative about it, but not not optimistic, and I'm not a Luddite because I made my living in technology. I'm just not so sure that this is going to do much to turn our culture around. So anything anyone have to offer on that, I'd appreciate to hear that.
Stephen Levy, do you have a sense of...
My guess is that, you know, this trend is going to make books easier to find, easier to discover. It's going to, you know, all the, these projects to scan these books and make libraries, the whole library searchable, will make things, open up books to those interested in it. But basically, I think your caller's instinct is right. The passion for books really comes from being brought up with a passion to books. And if parents don't get that into kids, it's an uphill climb for people. So, you know, I think probably Harry Potter, you know, if you look at it, might have done more to help the future reading than an e-book at this point.
I think Julia, who's calling us from Boston, has an insight into exactly this point. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Sheila. I guess my question is, how would your guests talk about the visual aspect of choosing a book, not necessarily the visual aspect of reading a book? But both my parents were English majors, and a lot of the books that I picked up as a child, but also picked up as a young adult, were things that my parents had on a shelf in a library. And I saw it, and I decided to read it. And I think somebody just said something about making a library accessible to a student, but what if they don't choose to look through it? Sometimes you need to be faced with a book before you open it up and read it. So how would they address that issue?
Sven?
Well, I can certainly relate to your question because for me, the choice has never been based on a sample chapter or anything. Getting involved with a book has always been a sort of three- or four-dimensional experience, and it involves a great deal of tactile handling and dipping in and out and sort of testing the not only the verbal waters but the whole sort of feel. And that's what I also meant by the historicized aspect of a book existing in time in a concrete object as a sort of feature of its time and place. You know, the loss of that won't be minimal. It would be significant. There's no way to compensate the sort of dimensionality that disappears, but a book has to disappear, apparently. So I'm not sure.
I think that's a great point. But these ways of, you know, that Sven's talking about, and your caller is talking about, have evolved along the course of books, and you know the way we know books now. And I think that there's other ways that of discovery, which you know I don't know if they'll be exactly as good or maybe even better. They'll be like, if your friend recognizes a book or recommends a book, it'll be something that you know can tell, hey, you've read these books, I think you're going to be interested in this book. That'll come to your attention there. There might be other kinds of visual ways to do this. Maybe there'll be some sort of electronic equivalent of a book cover which illuminates the contents of a book. I don't know, but certainly that's going to be a challenge for the sellers of electronic books to try to figure out ways to replace the process by which we choose books. And certainly, I think our electronic connectivity will give them a lot of opportunities to try to do that.
I think we have time to squeeze in one more call from Chris, who's calling from Boston. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Sheila. I'm an architect, and there was a time before the printed page when architecture was the chief form of cultural expression and technology, and I think it was Victor Hugo wrote an essay called this will kill that, the book will kill the building, that described that moment when the printed page replaced the architecture. The Gothic cathedral is the way of communicating our culture to us. And so from an architect's perspective, the bibliophiles are just finally getting their comeuppance. And I think the larger point is that, sadly, something will replace the book, whether it's video or whether it's this device that came out yesterday. And as sort of disturbing the notion as that is, it will happen. And I guess I'm just...
Chris, let Sven get a comment in because we're so close to out of time.
Well, I was just going to say that in that particular passage, what Hugo is talking about, the this represents the force of the book as enlightenment, and the that is actually the cathedral, and for him that stands for the whole world of religious superstition, and he saw the book as the vessel of enlightenment. But it was a physical book that he was holding on to when he pointed to the physical church. So now we have to reconfigure it all into virtual space and see what the trade-offs are going to be.
Stephen?
Well, I think, you know, look, you know, that we live at a time of change, and my hope, my belief is really that, you know, that the strength of an author's voice and the power of that form of transmission is going to survive in some way. If it doesn't, then, you know, what can you say? That wasn't what people wanted, but I feel...
Let me thank both of these authors, Stephen Levy, who is the author of The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness, and also the author of this week's cover story about reading in Newsweek, and Sven Burkertz, author of The Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in an Electronic Age. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.